Thanks very much. And thanks to you all for turning up on Saturday morning. I don't know how many of you are readers of the Sun-Times, but I think this Thursday there was a headline, the front page had a picture of Cardinal Francis George, who had preached a sermon at the Chicago Catholic Seminary here at the University of Chicago the week before. And the headline said, Cardinal George says, they don't hate us because we're white and rich. They hate us because we have no understanding of the rest of the world. And he was sort of thinking about his experience. He's very close to the hierarchy in Rome. He was thinking about his experience traveling around the world and experiencing this sort of growing sense of distrust that the United States is engendering in the rest of the world, and reflecting on it and saying, we simply have to start to understand other countries more than we do. And it's terrific to see you all here this morning to take part in that exercise along with me. I heard some Portuguese being spoken as I walked in the room this morning, so those of you who know some of this better than I do, please don't hesitate to speak. And I'm going to invite you, give you the same invitation that Irene gave you earlier on, which is to say, please stop me at any point. I'm used to being in this room, in this building, being interrupted, okay? So please do it. That would be great. Well, you have the misfortune to have to hear someone who was originally trained as a historian, and so I don't think you can understand any country without a brief historical overview, and this is going to be the history of Brazil in 5 seconds or less, okay? But what I've tried to do is pick out elements that I think are important for understanding the current context of the country, okay? So Brazil is, quote, discovered, right? In 1500 by Pedro Alvarez Cabral and revisited, I think, in 1 year later by Américo Vespúcio. So it's got 600 years of history of Western discovery. This next thing is important. The original economy of Brazil is a plantation economy. Now, what's been grown on those plantations changes over time. And originally it was sugar, and then it was coffee, and now it's products that make Brazil independent of foreign oil because it's figured out how to grow crops for alcohol that run cars. I was talking yesterday to a former director of development in the city of São Paulo, and he said in São Paulo now they produce no net carbon monoxide from their cars which is unbelievable, right? Brazil and the history of slavery goes back a very long way. And the first reference in written documents to slaves being in Brazil is as early as 1533. And I'm going to talk to you about one city. So this gentleman, Fernand Malagoin's docks in Rio de Janeiro, then it didn't have a name right, in 1519, he says, what a wonderful river. And he arrives there on January the 1st, so he names the city the River of January. Well, there is no river in Rio de Janeiro. He discovered a big bay, which is now called Guanabara Bay, because he thought it was a river. The city is called the River of January, right? And then in 1549, the Portuguese... There's this very interesting history that Spain was the predominant exploratory power in South America, right? And the Spanish and the Portuguese were fighting about which part of South America should be each of theirs. And in those days, if you had a dispute like that, you didn't go to the Security Council, you went to the Pope, right? And originally, a line was drawn to separate the Spanish interest from the Portuguese interest that would have cut off half of contemporary contemporary Brazil. And the Portuguese suddenly realized they were getting a bad deal. So they got the Pope to shift that line, and as a result, got themselves the largest country in South America. Always good to be in with the Pope. 1789, in February of 1789, George Washington is elected the first president of the United States by the Electoral College, that infamous organization. In June of that year, there's the storming of the Bastille, right? And in Brazil, there's the first major uprising against the Portuguese rule by a guy called Tiradentes, who those of you who speak Portuguese will know means the drawer of teeth. He was a dentist, right, in the state of Minas Gerais. And he organized a rebellion which didn't last for very long. And then this very curious thing happened as Napoleon was coming over the Alps, threatening both Spain and Portugal in his general conquest of Europe. The Portuguese royal family got very scared, so they jumped into their boats. And the entire royal court of Portugal came over to Brazil and ruled Portugal from Brazil, right? And so in 1815, Brazil was no longer a colony of Brazil. It became an integral part of the United Kingdom of Portugal. So Napoleon is defeated by our friends in England, and so João Sesto feels it's free to go home, and he goes home, and just a year later, Brazil declares itself independent. And you know, he has to pay for this independence by paying off the Portuguese to recognize Brazilian independence, and he also has to pay off the Brits. In the 19th century, if you wanted to do anything, you basically had to pay off the Brits. And basically what the Brits were doing there was using its fleet to protect Brazil from other countries which Britain didn't want to have any influence in Brazil. So the first form of parliamentary government gets established in the middle of the 19th century. And here's a figure, if we'd gone back a couple of hundred years, it would have been sugarcane that dominated the Brazilian economy. And by the 1870s, it's coffee that's dominating the Brazilian economy. And in 1871, so some years after the emancipation of slaves in the United States, Brazil starts to free the slave descendants of Africans. And they start by freeing the children of slaves, and then all slaves over 60 are freed, and then the remaining whatever number of slaves are freed in 1888. And then in 1889, people get fed up with a very much a father figure who is respected for all kinds of reforms, Dom Pedro II, and say it's time to leave, and so he leaves. And so Brazil gets its sort of complete independence from the last remnants of Portuguese rule without a shot being fired. As you see, I'm going through this at a rapid pace. And then in 1960, a completely new city is designed by a very distinguished contemporary architect, Oscar Mayer, in the middle of the country. Why? In order to try and develop the interior, because all the economic activity is on the coast. And Brasilia is declared the capital of Brazil, and you can probably say that Rio has never recovered from that fact. Now, here's where the United States comes into the picture. So the generals take over the country in a military coup in 1964, and Lyndon Baines Johnson sends the U.S. Aircraft carrier Forrestal off the coast of Rio just in case. Just in case what? Just in case the generals lose, right? So he sends them off there to basically back the military coup. The United States basically is the midwife of 20 years of military dictatorship in Brazil. And he hails the coup as the triumph of democratic forces over international communism. Right? Some things don't change. What was the nature of the military dictatorship? Well, I'm not going to talk about it when there are people in this room who experienced it. But there's a sort of general sense that it was this period of military dictatorship in South America was perhaps the most brutal in Chile and in Argentina. And that Brazil, it wasn't quite as brutal, but there were plenty of people who went in fear of their lives and who disappeared, never to be seen again. Then in 1985, the generals march back to the barracks and a democratically elected government takes over. And it was very interesting. I was watching President Lula's acceptance speech last Sunday night. And for the first 10 minutes, all he talked about was this election shows that we have firmly reestablished democracy in Brazil. This is now the sort of whatever it is, the fourth or fifth election after the generals have gone back. But there's still a sense, particularly among the population who experienced the military dictatorship, that it is a real achievement, right, to have firmly replaced an instituted democratic rule. And he said an interesting thing. He said, you know, there are other countries that are richer than ours with a longer history of democracy who still haven't figured out how to cast the votes and count the votes in an election. And in Brazil, it's all done by computers, right? So you know 10 minutes after the poll has closed, who's won. So I think this figure is perhaps slightly lower than it should be, but Brazil has a population of 186 million, the sixth largest country in the world. And Brazil has, at least depending how you define, right, one mega city, São Paulo. It turns out that São Paulo started its sort of dramatic growth in the 1930s and the 1950s expanded massively. And now it's only growing at the rate of about 2% a year. And that's not from migration in any longer, that's from natural increase. Partly because, like many cities in the US, the manufacturing economy has collapsed because of foreign competition, and there are greater opportunities elsewhere. So São Paulo has a metro region of 18 million, Rio of 12 million, although the city proper in Rio has a population of 6 million. And roughly 20% of the population of Rio live in these low-income communities which have the name favelas, which I checked out the other day where the name came from. In the 1890s, there was a revolt in northeastern Brazil against the central government. And the revolt was centered on a hill called the Hill of Favela, Morro da Favela. And then when it was the 4th Brazilian Regiment marched back from putting down this revolt to Rio, they had nowhere to live, so they settled on a hill. And it reminded them of the hill they had attacked in northeastern Brazil. And so low-income communities from that, they called their community a favela. And then that name stuck for low-income communities in the country. Now, Irene was pointing out earlier this morning that Brazil has, depends which year it is, it has somewhere between the 10th and the 14th largest gross domestic product in the world. But there's this, how many of you know about this way of measuring income inequality? It's called the Gini coefficient of inequality. If the income distribution in a country is completely equal, if everybody's earning exactly the same amount, it's the Gini coefficient is one, is zero. If it is completely unequal, the Gini coefficient is one. So it varies between zero and one, right? And I think the United States is at 0.42 and Brazil is at 0.67. So you have the one of the wealthiest countries in the world with, the last time I checked, the fourth largest Gini coefficient of inequality in the world, with the only countries that exceeding that being Swaziland, the Central African Republic, and Sierra Leone. And it's this long history of the domination of a plantation class and then of either laborers or landless people that has survived till this day. And I checked this figure before I came. I think roughly 40 million people in Brazil exist on $2 or less a day, and 20 million people exist on $1 or less a day, which is just, I think, very hard for people in this country to conceive of. Anybody, right, existing on $2 a day or less, never mind such a huge percentage of the population. And this is in no order here, but it's interesting that of all the Africans who survived the Middle Passage, 40% of them ended up in Brazil, only 4% ended up in the United States. And I'm going to talk about this at the end because it's a very controversial issue, particularly with foreigners like myself who do some work in Brazil. In the US census, for the first time in the 2000 census, in addition, Bill, describing yourself as African-American, Pacific Islander, Aleutian, you know, that weird list we have in this country, in the 2000 census, for the first time, you could describe yourself as mixed race, okay? That had been objected to by Hispanic groups and African-American groups because they saw it as a way of diminishing their political power. Does anyone have a sense of how many people elected to call themselves mixed-income people, mixed-race people, in the 2000 census? Guess. I think it was 1.8 or something like that, right? Now, in Brazil, you don't describe yourself by those weird racial categories we have here. You describe yourself by color. And basically, 55% of the population describe themselves as white, 38%. So 40% describe themselves as being mixed race. And as I say, this is something very hard for a foreigner to get all the dimensions of. But I will venture this statement that there is a sense that it is and proudly is a mixed-race country, right? That the average Brazilian is proud of the fact that it's a mixed-race country. And you know, in this country, we had this sort of saying, a drop black and you're completely black, right? In Brazil, at the end of the 19th century, the government opened the doors to Europeans, white Europeans, in order, quote, to lighten the population, the skin of the population, not to increase the number of whites per se, but to bring in whites who would intermarry and therefore make the color of the population lighter, which would never have been a US sensibility, because in the US sensibility, right, you couldn't lighten anybody, right? Right. So now, I say this is controversial. There's a big fight going on at the Ford Foundation right now. Someone has accused the Ford Foundation of funding citizens of the United States to go down to Brazil and tell people that they are not conscious of their black heritage. Now, it's a very complicated situation because the blacker you are, the poorer you are. Yet at the same time, there is this sense of mixed raceness, which I think it's very hard for people in North America to understand. So it's a very complicated situation. What happened? Where am I? Let's go on. Okay. Just a few sort of comparative figures about the kinds of problems that Brazilians face. And I've already talked about the number of people living on very low incomes. The infant mortality rate is now 29 per 1,000 live births, and this is a huge improvement over what it was 10 years ago. Although that still makes it the 127th worst infant mortality rate in the world. The United States is 36th in infant mortality, but at a much lower rate. When the generals marched back to the barracks, you had the beginning of the continuation of democratic government in Brazil, but enormous economic problems. And the economic problems were manifest in a just unbelievable inflation rate. In 1993, the inflation rate was 2,447%. Right? So you got your paycheck and immediately went out and spent it all because that afternoon, everything would be much more expensive. And today it's under the Federal Reserve Board of the United States wouldn't like this figure of 7.6%. Their target for inflation in the United States is 2%, but it's a huge difference, and it's one sign of a return to economically normal life. Let me talk just very briefly about the indigenous population of Brazil. It's very hard to count. They didn't leave the same kind of monuments as people who came down across the Bering Straits and moved through South America left in Mexico, for example. But the guess is, I've got 5 to 6 million here, that there were between 3 and 6 million indigenous people in Brazil at the time that the Europeans stepped foot on the country. And today that's down to 300,000. They were decimated for all the usual reasons. And what people tell me is in Brazil there was an additional reason, which was they simply refused to work for the conquering nation, right, who held all the economic power in their hands. And so a lot of them just starved to death, right? And it was only after that fact that was realized that you get the huge importation of folks from Africa. I just want to show you the sort of tourist Brazil, and then we'll talk about the non-tourist Brazil. This is the statue of Christ the Redeemer, which overlooks Rio. And I'm wondering, is this Santa Marta down here?
Yeah, I think so.
This, right underneath this is a sort of medium-sized favela. Under the open arms of Christ. There's another one. The story of this is very interesting. The Brazilians put out an international competition for doing the statue in the 1930s or so. And their only condition was that it not look like the Statue of Liberty. and so, in fact, it was a French architect who finally came up with this kind of Art Deco Christ, right? This is Copacabana, the famous beaches of Rio that the tourist goes and sees and loves, and indeed the rest of the population. A typical beach scene in Rio, and the sidewalk in Copacabana, and carnival, right, which is an experience you can't describe. You only have to experience. You have to be there to experience. I have a, you know, you can tell my accent is English, right? So I have this very interesting comparison. For years and years and years, I was forced to watch the St. Patrick's Day parade in Chicago. And the difference between that parade and Carnival, it's like, it's a different universe. And no guesses for which I prefer. And a sort of, I think this is Baja. This is a sort of modern, once suburb of Rio. So this is sort of middle class and tourist Rio, and the famous picture of Guanabara Bay with Sugarloaf Mountain here. This is what the tourist gets to see and enjoy. Why not? Okay. And here, I think this is Jocinho. This is the largest favela in Rio. And so let's just talk about some aspects of it. It's not a cardboard shantytown, right? This is concrete buildings, and some of them are reinforced with steel, but very, very crowded, right? They're on the hills. In this country, if you're on the hills, you know, you'd be upper middle class, right? It's the reverse in Rio. But the buildings are, in fact, very tiny, and sometimes two or three families will be living in one of these buildings, and when a new family comes along, you just build another level on top. And there's another one stacked up against the hill, and you see, you know, women in their 80s who buy all the retailers at most of the retailers at the bottom, because that's the best place to be, because that's where the transportation is to the rest of the city. And you see women in their early 80s, right, carrying shopping bags all the way up these extraordinarily steep hills every day, just to keep life going. And there's another one. And as Irene was saying earlier, just across the street from here will be upper middle class neighborhoods, which turns out to be quite good for the residents in one respect. It means the women can find jobs as domestics. The Brazilian middle class is not middle class in US terms, but most middle class people have folks who help in their homes, and very often they come from these communities. And this gives you a much better sense with electric pipes and wires and water pipes just sort of going over the tops of the houses, right? And very, very, very close living with very tiny amounts of room per family. And then a pervasive sense of violence. The drug traffickers in Brazil walk around with the heaviest of arms, AK-47s, openly in the streets. Although in each favela, the number of people who are actually working for the drug traffickers is a very small percentage of the whole population. Someone once told me in the favela I'm going to talk about, Caju, that perhaps only 120 people were actually in the drug trafficking gangs out of a population of 25,000. Their presence is very, very heavily felt, and no one goes up against them because they kill with impunity, right? And there's another not so good picture, and another one of a favela. So let me tell you about, come down from this sort of very broad and quick overview, to talk about the condition of youth in one favela. This is a favela called Caju, and it's very different from the ones I've shown you. It's not on the hillsides. It's in the old port district of Rio, which is relevant because it's next to the central business district, which means it's very accessible for low-skilled jobs. So my suspicion is, and I'm still trying to pin this down, that the general demographics of Caju are much better than the average demographics of favela in Rio. There's a big division between favelas in the southern zone, which are close to middle-class neighborhoods and where people can get jobs as domestics, and favelas in the northern zone, where you may be 2 hours away from your job, right? And just to get a sense of this, and let me also, I really need to do some thanks here. There's an organization in Rio called the Institute for the Study of Work and Society. Its acronym is IETS, I-E-T-S. And you can find its website, and it has an English language version by just Googling IETS. Did a huge survey of Caju, why Caju is lost in the midst of memory. Of both the residents and youth, and this is where all my information came from. And unlike trying to get data from another research institute in this country, they were very nice and said, listen, we don't have time to analyze this data. Here it is. And I've, in my spare time, have been looking at this data over the last year. So Caju has 24,000 people in 7,000 households, no health clinics, one public school, one police post, no banks or post offices, and four crèches, so childcare centers, right? It has 184 bars, There are bars on every corner, 35 churches. So the bars and churches compete for which is the most common institution. Small grocery stores, which can be very, very tiny, et cetera, et cetera. 54 vacant stores. So although there is a lot of activity, there is also a lot of economic decay. Now, how do you put in perspective the daily life of people? I think you have to remember my figure about 40 million people living under $2 a day, right? But it turns out most households have electric light, most have a refrigerator, half of them have a washing machine. Let's just go down this list. I think the thing that is different, the thing that is markedly different between a low-income community in the United States and one in Brazil is the very low level of car ownership, right? So only 10% of folks have a car, which means they're heavily reliant on public transportation, which although it's expensive, is very, very expensive in terms of average incomes, right? Cell phones, no, 38%, you can't say they're ubiquitous, right? A low level of computer ownership, right? So that's the sort of background. Now let's talk about, so how well educated are youth in Caju facing, like youth everywhere else, a very, very competitive international economy? Well, the figures I think are very, Susan.
Can I ask you one more
please. Well, people would be going out of the favela to go to school, right? Right, 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 right. Not at all. So 60% of 15 to 17-year-olds have not completed grade school, right? So the majority of kids, of young people in Caju have not completed grade school. And if you look at the older population, the adults, 73% have not completed grade school. So the percent of kids who are completing grade school is increasing, but what that represents is not necessarily such a great thing because, you know, we have this great debate in this country about promotion by age and not promotion by achievement, right? That's also a phenomenon in Brazil. So the fact they have completed grade school doesn't necessarily talk about their literacy skills, for example. It's also true that a number of adults, I've got 20% here, take vocational courses. They take vocational courses in computers, in mechanics, in sort of beauty shops, and so on. The general sense is, and this is something we're looking into in this research, is that the courses they take are sometimes not worth the paper they're written on. That they might take a course for 2 or 3 months, but the level of instruction is not very good. Brazil has two very, very good organizations. Their acronym is SINACI and SINAI, which provide post-schooling professional training. But our suspicion is, and this is something we're trying to figure out, that low-income kids don't get into them, first of all, because they don't have the basic qualifications, and secondly, because they're just far too expensive. And these two post-secondary training institutions have a long history. They go back to the 1940s and 1950s. But our suspicion right now is that kids from low-income communities are locked out for that reason. We have a very high percentage of young people who report dropping out of school at least once. You drop out, you come back in. There's a lot of movement backwards and forwards. And it's very interesting. Several questions were asked on this survey about why did you drop out? Why were you failing at school? And although the quality of schools is very low, it's almost like no one blames the school. They blame themselves. I am not able to study, right? And when my colleagues at Yetz, first of all, did this survey, they said they didn't analyze it by gender. So I analyzed it by gender and found that, you know, almost 20% of girls dropped out of school because of pregnancy. That was the one of the main avenues out of school because then they have a whole bunch of responsibilities. Half of the kids, and the kids in this survey are from 10 to 24, failed a grade at least once. And let me try and remember this. I think something like 30% of them are at least 3 years behind grade level. So they're massively behind, not very demanding grade levels, right? And the main determinants, we ran a regression analysis of this, of being behind in grade level is gender. If you're a young man, you're much more likely to be behind grade level than if you're a young woman. But it's also, this is the sins of the parents being visited on the children to the fourth generation, right? This is biblical stuff. Two of the main determinants of how well you're doing at school are whether your parents can read and whether your parents completed elementary education. And let me just make this point here. It's very easy to develop a view of a low-income community as being homogenous, right? You see how different it is from the world you inhabit and also from the worlds of the middle class in the city. It turns out this favela is very heterogeneous. It's very heterogeneous in terms of income, although it's all low. I think the average, I think it's sort of a trimodal distribution of income from what are called two minimum salaries to over 1,200 or 600 US dollars a month. So there's a huge difference in income distribution. There's a huge difference in educational achievement. And there's actually a huge difference in the job aspirations of younger people. And it's a very, very good reminder that what to us looks like, right, a very, very homogeneous situation is in fact very complex and contains people at very different income levels and very different educational levels, depending on factors like their parents' abilities, right? Okay, so what are the work histories of young people in Caju? Let's say first of all that one of the struggles that Brazil, like many other countries, has faced with help from the ILO, the International Labour Organization, is in fact to stop child labour. Right? Child labour being the phenomenon that keeps you out of school. Right? And to a very large extent, Brazil has been successful, particularly in urban areas, in reducing child labour. In rural areas, how do you stop somebody from looking for the eggs, right? But now the problem is the disconnection of young people from the regular job market when they're the appropriate age. And here I have to talk about a big cultural difference because you may be surprised at some of these figures. If you go to college in the US, right, the ice cream shop and the coffee shop, right, and the library are manned by students, right, who are working their way through college. That is not a phenomenon in Brazil simply because there are not enough jobs. And those jobs are filled by people who are heads of households. Right? And one of the things I noticed about Irene's university is that the people who are at the lunch counters and the people who are selling things, they're middle-aged people and sometimes older people, right? They're not students because the competition for jobs is so high, right? There aren't jobs for them. So I have this figure here that in the US, 40% of 15 to 17-year-olds work during the year, in the summer almost 50%, and the same figure in Brazil is 20%, at least those of that are counted, right? And the definition of working in Brazil is a very low threshold level. If you work for 1 hour a week and you are paid, you are working, right? So it's a very low threshold for counting whether or not you're working. So these folks, so when we get to the 18 to 21-year-old group, 55% of young men are working, and the corresponding figure for women is 36%. And why? Well, because a lot of the young women are working in their own households for no money. They're looking after the kids. As their parents travel 2 or 3 hours to get to work, not in Caju, but in other favelas, they're washing the dishes, they're cooking the food, they're basically running the households, right? Of those young women who did work, 30% worked as domestics, so they're working in middle-class households. We would call a work card, although we don't have such things, but which in Brazil is a carteira de trabalho. It means you have a card that provides you certain benefits, right? Certain health benefits and certain retirement benefits. And one of the challenges of the Brazilian economy is that 50% of the adults work without a work card. And the reason they work without a work card is because there's a very high tax on employment, right? So if you're an employer and you're trying to hire somebody, right, you'd much rather hire them informally so you don't have to pay the work tax, right? and then hire them formally, and I think it's 50% of wages. It's a huge figure, the work tax. And an economist friend said that the first thing the Brazilian government has to do is figure out how to get other sources of income than the work tax, because if they abolish that, a whole bunch of people will move from the informal sector to the formal sector and gain the protections that ensue from being part of the formal sector. Right. It's not an income tax. It is a tax that employers have to pay on everybody they hire. So I guess it's the equivalent of the tax that we pay in the US as the employer part of Social Security. Right. Well, you know, whether money for pensions goes into a pension fund or whether, as in the States, it's really a pay-as-you-go scheme. One of the great myths about Social Security in this country is it's going bankrupt. It can't go bankrupt because 70% of the current payout of Social Security comes from current taxes. And I don't know the answer to that question, Susan, whether it's a fund or whether it's current taxes. Yeah.
It's so that it's more akin to
Yes. And you know there's been a great debate recently, well, we won't go into that, but minimum wages and Walmart, right? There's a wonderful, I have the power of diverting myself, right? There's a wonderful institute in Washington called the Economic Policy Institute, which does analysis of what's happening to work and income patterns in the United States. And every 2 years, it does a study called the State of Working Americans, and it's just come out with this report, and it presented it in Chicago last week. And so I asked the question, because I had this Walmart debate in my head, right? Should Walmart be forced to pay a minimum wage? Does the minimum wage restrict the number of jobs? I mean, it does increasing the level of the minimum wage reduce the jobs available, and therefore have a very serious unintended consequence. And they were rather upset about being asked this question in a room full of good progressives. But they said, in fact, the only study that showed that an increase in the minimum wage reduced the number of jobs was from a panel set up by George Bush to argue for a reduction in the level of Social Security. And every other study that has been done shows that a modest increase in the minimum wage will have virtually no impact on job creation. So, sorry about that. So what were the determinants of getting? First of all, actually, I think my colleagues were surprised by this figure that 40% of 18 to 21-year-olds had a job with a carteira. I bet anything that in the favelas in the northern zone, that's going to be a much, much lower figure. But this favela is right next to the richest job area in Rio. And the determinants of getting such a job, not surprisingly, were age, but it was also working outside the community. In general, jobs inside low-income communities are not going to come with a work card because it's very, very small retail, basically. And finishing elementary school. You're not going to get anywhere without finishing elementary school. Yeah.
So is it the person that gets the work card or is it the job that has
the job has to provide it for the person but can only do so if they start paying, right, the employer tax.
If you leave that position, you don't take your work card with you?
No, work card is connected to a job, right?
And it is very expensive. You are fined if you, as an employer, you are fined. And what the phenomenon here, I think, the way I understand it, is that even if the women are working as maids, if they are working on a regular basis, more than like once a week and over a year, they'll be the employers will be fined, and it's expensive. So that has raised since because these are recent rights on the regulation to pay maids. It's recent. That is why it seems this high. It is. Unusual and recent.
Yeah.
Yes. So because maybe they are in a city and the very close to the city is very easy to be caught. And besides, there are so many lawyers in so many universities that are barely recognized, graduating, that they will go to the maids and tell them you can make some money and he will make, or she will make some money too. So see the
right.
The connections there.
So it's the equivalent of ambulance chasing. You don't chase an ambulance, you chase a maid, right? And remember, in the US, we've had the same issue with Nannygate, right? Mm-hmm. Someone's running for political office, and it turns out they're not paying Social Security for the domestic help. But the scale of the problem is much, much bigger in Brazil. So let me just stop here a second, see whether... So basic summary of education and work is that you have a huge bunch of kids who are not succeeding in very low-level schools, right? There is a school close to where we live in the mountains, which is a public school with absolutely wonderful teachers, where the average working class kid goes. It does not have a library. Right? There's nowhere to put books. It doesn't have a library. Right? In the 10th richest country in the world. Right? And work experience is very spotty. And Irene was talking earlier about this very powerful discrimination based partly on skin color, but really based on where you live. Right? And if you report to an employer that you live in one of the favelas, and that makes you one out of five of everybody who lives in Rio de Janeiro, you're going to have a much, much harder time of getting a job than if you live in a middle-class neighborhood. Okay. So let me be silly enough to try and sum up here. I really stay away from this debate about the degree to which race is ignored in Brazil, because it's extraordinarily complicated, and I don't think it's for me, someone coming from the outside, to talk about. But let me just give you an example. I have someone who helps teach me Portuguese, who came to this country as a maid, and got a green card, coming as a maid, and was then abused by her employer and left, and without a word of English, tried to make it on her own in Chicago. And when people say to her, which country are you from, she says to them, well, you guess. And most often they say, you're from Ethiopia. So she looks like she's Ethiopian, right? And when I talk to her and say, well, what race are you, Hosanna? She says, 14, and lists a group of races that includes Chinese, right? And I said, well, you know, what race are you considered in Brazil? She says, normal, usual, I'm like everybody else, right? And that's just a personal example to say that it's one has to be very, very careful translating the experience and the discourse about race in the United States to a country like Brazil, where there is a long tradition of racial mix. Nonetheless, democracy came to Brazil, the country was accused of not talking about race and ignoring the fact that the blacker you are, the poorer you are, right?
One question I have is, like you just mentioned before about the favelas, like if you live in a favela,
right,
that almost becomes, I mean, is there a connection between...
Living in a favela and race?
Yeah.
There are favelas which are very white, and there are favelas which are also black. A lot of the migration of the population that resulted in the building of the favelas in Rio was from the agriculturally decimated and drought-ridden northeast, and a lot of those folks were quite white, right?
So it's not that clear a distinction.
It's not that clear a distinction. I mean, how many of you have seen the sort of recent famous films from Brazil, City of God and, yeah? It does look, and City of God, incidentally, was a favela which was in downtown Rio and was literally moved, right? It was carted off to an empty part of the city. And there it does look very black. Incidentally, my two-line summary of City of God is ritualized violence. You would never believe that you have 95% of the population in this favela living normal lives and trying to live normal lives, nonetheless, under this enormous threat of violence. But all you got in that film was violence. Okay, the income inequalities are just enormous, and they stem from plantation days. There are states in Brazil, particularly the smaller rural states, that are still dominated politically by the plantation elites. I wonder if there's an equivalent in the US. There's an equivalent in London, which is something like 15% of London is owned by the Duke of Bedfordshire, which goes back to medieval times, right? And I don't think there is an equivalent in this country of the of the continuation of the concentration of political power and land ownership, right, in the plantation?
Then
there's Texas. Yeah. But the income inequalities are huge. And let me tell you some of the problems. One of the problems is this dependence on the work tax. Another problem is that someone was telling me that, okay, there's a social security system, the equivalent of 70% of the payout of the social security system goes to 30% of the population who are public employees who happen to be civil servants in the military and in the judiciary and other sort of protected classes, right? So there's a huge disparity in the payout of the social security system, right? Do I have this later on? No, I don't. So let me talk about it here. Political change in Brazil is very, very difficult. Why? There are currently, although this is going to change, there are currently 18 political parties in the Congress in Brasilia. You need 12 to pass any substantive reform, right? And as someone, this guy from São Paulo was telling me yesterday, there are political parties who agree on everything except agreeing with each other, right? So you have political parties of the left who have exactly the same electoral platform, but they will not collaborate. And I don't know how many of you have been following this, but the big scandal that came out before the election was that the Lula administration, like every administration before him, was paying parliamentarians, I use the English term, apologies, for voting for the government's program, right? They were getting a monthly salary of, I think, 1,500 reais or something for voting for the government program. Why? Because that was the only way to get anything through the Congress. There has been a very, very important constitutional change, which has just come into force, which is that now if you get below a certain population, a certain percentage of the popular vote, you will no longer be on the ballot next time round as a party, right? So what is happening, the parties are now being forced to merge, and I don't know what the projection is, I don't know whether anyone knows, but it's going to come down from 18. But my only point is that deep structural change, which is desperately needed, is just extraordinarily difficult to accomplish. Lula tried to change the social security system and make it more equitable, and he just failed because he couldn't put the votes together. Now, you know what we've done in Chicago, right? We tore down Cabrini-Green, we tore down the Robert Taylor Homes. I guess there are people in this room who never saw the Robert Taylor Homes, right? What a thought. But anyways, 8 miles of public housing down the lakefront, right? And what we've done, of course, is to displace those people to the southern suburbs, right? Why? Because the city is gentrifying like crazy, which is great for the city. It's great for the city's tax base. But it means that rental levels are going up and low-income people are being moved to the southern suburbs where they're worse off. Why? Because transportation is lousy and because a whole bunch of townships are either corruptly or incompetently governed. And they're further away from the greatest job engines in the region, which are in the northwest, right? You can't replace the public, the favelas in Rio and São Paulo. There isn't any room, right? And so one effort that started to deal with this project was, this problem was a project called Favela Bairro, which just literally means the community of the favela, which tried to do infrastructure improvements in 51 of the currently 800 favelas in Rio. Here was the problem. There were several problems. As people were doing this infrastructure development, nobody thought about local jobs, right? And no one thought about how to structure this infrastructure change so it created more economic development the day after the construction crews walked out of the favelas. But third, the infrastructure improvements were so good that people came from other favelas and the population went up and the net quality of life was not improved. So you can't do it clearly favela at a time. You've got to figure out how to do it in a bunch of communities at the same time. And then I thought I was going to end on a positive note. Perhaps there's another slide. The other problem is just enormous corruption in the police force and the judiciary, which is partly a result of very low wages, right? So and every now and again, a new police force is created, right, to try and deal with the problems of corruption, and then that itself gets corrupted. and a huge culture of violence, as Irene gave the figure of whatever it was, 1,300 people being killed by the police in São Paulo in 1 year, right? And you know, this term, a no-go area, it comes from the British government fighting Northern Ireland, basically parts of Northern Ireland that 10 years ago the police and the army just didn't go into, right? The favelas are essentially no-go areas for the police. What they do is, when the traffickers are silly enough to come out of the favelas and burn a couple of buses, they then go in literally with all guns blazing. I mean, they just shoot indiscriminately, right? They just shoot everything in sight, right? And as a result, the residents of the favelas have a mixed response to the drug traffickers. On the one hand, they don't want their kids to get caught up, because if they do, the likelihood is they will die in their early 20s. That's just the likelihood if they get caught up with the drug traffickers, right? On the other hand, to some degree, the drug traffickers keep the also violent police out of their neighborhoods most of the time, right? Do I have a page of hope? I have a page of hope. So the country has seen massive improvements over, you know, the reduction of inflation. Currently, the currency, the hei, sits roughly 2 to the dollar. Actually, it's 2.12 or something. When Lula started to rise in the polls in 2001, the value of the hei against the dollar went from 1.8 to 4, right? Because the international currency speculators thought he was going to be elected and that the economy was collapsed, so they were going to make their fortune out of currency speculation. And it speaks enormously to his political skill that while he did engage in quite a bit of income distribution, not enough, not nearly enough, but some, he also managed to keep Wall Street and the IMF and the World Bank comparatively happy. And as a result, the economy expanded, right? The question now is, how do the fruits of that expansion move down the income ladder, right? But that's one success story. Another success story is this program which used to be called Bolsa Escola, a stipend for school, and is now called a stipend for the family. It's a small subsidy, what, 50 reais a month? Depends on the state. $25 a month, right? And in order to qualify for it, it reminds me of the earned income tax credit. You get it if you work. Here you get it if 80% the children in your family attend school 80% of the time. There are two other conditions: that all the kids under one are vaccinated, and the third condition is that any pregnant woman or nursing woman attends a health clinic once every 3 months. So in other words, they tied the receipt of this stipend to, you know, adaptive behavior, let's call it that, right? I was talking recently to someone from the World Bank who was explaining the problems of non-school attendance in Mexico, and they said the problem is the transition between elementary school and high school. You might have, I think in Brazil, 90% of the kids in elementary school, but they don't show up in high school, and this is also the problem is normal. Why am I talking about this? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Yeah. And the World Bank is convinced that this Bolsa Escola or Bolsa Familia actually, in Mexico, increased the number of kids making the transition from elementary to high school by 30%.
Yeah, we have now 8 years of school, an average level.
Which is a big increase over.
Yeah, from 1 year, an increase
right.
In about 4 years.
Right. And this was your classic good experiment. It was a randomized experiment with World Bank economists poring over the results. I don't know how you sum up the basic problem with education. There just simply does not seem to be the political will to improve the quality of the public school. And I don't know how you understand that, and I don't know how you do anything about it. And there's also the problem, as the ILO points out, that in some countries the problem with labor is demand side, and in some countries it's supply side, and it's Brazil, it's supply side. There simply aren't the jobs in the economy, right? And that's why on the streets of Rio you see people of all ages, but particularly kids and young and sort of middle-aged men, you know, selling small things to try and make a living, right? And I've talked about the discrimination against kids from the favelas. Lula has this very interesting program, which I think is only a year old, which is basically a subsidy to employers of $1,500 a year, which you get in bi-monthly doses to hire new young workers, right? I was at the other day in Pilsen in an organization called National Able, which places disconnected workers, right, back into the job market. And it was very interesting. So it was mainly Hispanic population. I was talking to the people who ran the program. Well, why do people come to you? They come to us because they've dropped out of school, they've got in trouble with the law. And I said, okay, and what's the characteristic of these kids that pushes them into that situation? And without hesitation, they said, they have no adults in their lives. They're in families where no adults are looking after them, no one cares what happens, and we're the first adults in their lives that show up at their high school graduations, that get them out of bed in the morning if they don't show up to their training courses, that is on the other end of the line where they're trying to explain to a supervisor why they lost their temper when they were told to do something at work. And it was just this very strong sense that just basic lack of caring adults was what had pushed these young kids in Pilsen into this situation where they were disconnected from school and disconnected from the job market. And then there's this very controversial program which Lula introduced in 2003, that 20% of places in the University of Brasilia and 40% of places in state universities had to be, I changed this this last sentence and it clearly didn't get changed, with black ancestry or indigenous ancestry or with mixed ancestry, right? And its attempt to deal with the fact that the public universities, no tuition, right? You get into there by a competitive examination called the vestibular, very, very tough exam. And so middle-class kids were getting in and then getting their way paid, right, throughout college, which was a double whammy on low-income kids. They weren't getting the benefit, and their parents were paying the taxes that were paying for this program, right? So not only did this force the reservation of certain places in public universities for kids with a mixed race background, it also subsidized the private universities to take more mixed race kids. Same problem as you can imagine here. The problem is, okay, so the kids get to the university and then they're way, way behind. So this is only going to work if the universities, in their turn, provide programs that will keep the kids able to cope with, right, the challenges of the university they've just got into. So on one level, you know, you have these desperate statistics about average wage and desperate statistics about the closed communities of favelas and the difficulties of getting outside the favelas. Incidentally, I asked the person who directs this organization, National Able, who's a colleague of mine, why they opened an office in Pilsen. She said, it's very easy. We had training courses downtown, we had computer courses downtown, and no one would come, and they wouldn't come because it was a foreign country. Right? You cannot overestimate, right, the degree of isolation, right, and the degree of fear of the outside world of generations of families that have grown up in these intensely poor and intensely isolated communities. So those are that's the bad news. I mean, I think the good news is that there are enormously good intentions and there are well worked out programs. And the question now is not only can they be passed and funded, but they can also be implemented, right? So a work in progress. And I think all I'm trying to do is to give you a snapshot of one country and then to encourage you, in the words of Cardinal George, and I'm the son of a Baptist minister, so I don't usually quote Catholic cardinals, but to do something about the fact that we are deeply ignorant of the rest of the world and that that has terrible consequences, and it's in our hands to do something about that. And thanks for sharing. Happy to try to answer questions.
We do have about 20 more minutes for question and answers.
Or to refer the questions to other people in the room who are more likely to know the answers.
This might be a simple question, but so what is something you can do? I mean, I'm young, I'm just starting in my profession, and don't have much experience, but would like direction as far as...
Right.
Some of these issues.
Well, I think we should all join in this conversation, okay? And it just shouldn't be me. But let me start off by saying, I think people get interested in other countries for a whole variety of reasons, right? Their great-great-grandmother came there, or, you know, the guy they dated in high school came from there, or whatever, right? And I think what you should think about in your own experience is where you have some kind of connection to another country, and just tell yourself, I'm going to learn more about it. And you know, 3 years ago, there was a great debate at the University of Chicago about the core curriculum, right? The sacred grail at the University of Chicago. And the question was, should the core curriculum be opened up so people could do, my God, a junior year abroad at the University of Chicago? And could it be opened up so that people could learn a foreign language, right? And incidentally, Harvard, which took the line until a few years ago that Harvard is such a valuable experience, why would you want to spend any time out of it while you're an undergraduate, right? Under its late lamented president, who said very silly things about the mathematical competence of women, changed its core curriculum so you could do a year abroad and you could learn a foreign language. So my first plea is, please learn another language, okay? It's a lot of fun, right? Become a citizen of the world, learn another language. Now, what would the rest of you say to this question? How do you start to make a difference, get involved in the rest of the world?
I really think that we need to not think just about the rest of the world, but you know, the connection between the rest of the world and here. You know, and this really is a city with hundreds of nationalities and people, and not that you have to stay here, but that's an important place to also start. You know, Pilsen is, what, 80% Mexican, probably about 70% of those people not born here, I mean, within the last 10 or 15 years, all right? So, I mean, I think it's finding the connections, because I think there is a little bit of a danger of just thinking of the other as somebody abroad, and, you know, those are the people who need to, you know, help, and this and that, the other, and it's the connections, I think, that are important. But language is important. I mean, Spanish is a good place to start.
And you're still at the age where you can learn the language easily, so. Let's, before we go to another question, any other comments on this question? Yeah,
I think my sense is always that, you know, there's no such thing as something that's new. So realistically, we've sat for an hour and a half or so, and this is about Brazil, or about Rio de Janeiro. But that, I mean, you could very easily change some lines in the slides, and that's here. This is no different. You know, nothing anywhere else is any different in its own way than here. And I think that sometimes we have a real problem in the United States of looking at the world or looking at somewhere else as being very different, whereas this example is a metaphor for here. And I think that by looking at very often situations elsewhere, we can find out a lot about what we ignore here or what we choose to ignore here.
Also, start with your friends some of the great debates. And let me give you one of the great debates which we've been having with a number of friends recently as 2 nights ago. You know, the French 2 years ago forbade the wearing Muslims cover young Muslim women, right, covering their hair in public schools. And the same debate going on in Germany with Turkish guest workers. And the former British Foreign Secretary, who used to be a radical politician, he used to be chair of the National Students Union, Jack Straw, said that wearing a veil in England was an anti-patriotic act, right? So start these debates, right? why is it that so many countries now are so uptight, right? There are two sides to this debate, as Naina will be the first to tell you. But why is it that we're so worried about people who behave in a different way? And should there be a standard of dress, right? Should Muslim women be allowed to cover everything except their eyes? And start talking about your friends, and you will start getting into some very, very interesting debates, right? But you know, get past the headlines is the invitation. But we had another question.
I was going to ask you about microlending because I saw that someone, you know, it looks like you're involved in that. I saw someone,
well,
I don't remember the name.
I'm glad you asked, because this is what I do in my vocational as opposed to avocational life. You know that recently Muhammad Yunus, who started the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, got the Nobel Prize for Peace, and he figured out a way of lending money to very low-income women. Who then sort of bought a cow or a sewing machine or something and started a sort of small economic venture. And there's a sense in which that's become a model for economic development in the whole world. And it both has an importance and it's been overrated as a way. Why has it been overrated? Well, there are only so many people you want sewing clothes and only many so people you want milking cows, right? And at some point the market gets saturated, right? Microcredit is, and also the term itself, people tend to think about people doing things in their own home. In Brazil, there's a real problem about small businesses getting access to small business credit, right? Let's call it that, not microcredit, small business credit. And there's a problem because Brazil has this tradition of runaway inflation, and someone who lends to a low-income person is worried by the time that money is paid back, their profit will have disappeared in inflation, right? There's another reason. The average large bank in the United States, I'm going to bore you with my subject matter now, makes a profit of 18%. That's what the large banks are looking for. The small banks are looking for 12%. In Brazil, the average large bank makes a profit of 23%. So you've got an extraordinarily wealthy banking economy, which is using this fear of inflation to charge exorbitant prices to small business people. And it's a real problem, because how can you start or expand a small business without access to credit? Now what's going to happen is HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, which is in 84 countries, and Citigroup are going to move in with credit cards that charge 30 or 40% interests. So it is a real problem of how small businesses can get access to decently priced credit. It's a big issue. And there are actually some state banks that are supposed to do this lending, and the sort of paperwork and the bureaucracy is so great. Here's just another interesting fact. I think it's interesting. The World Bank criticizes countries that make it very hard to establish small businesses. In Australia, it takes an average of 5 days of paperwork to open a small business. In Brazil, it takes 180 days. So there are structural things in the economy, right, which stop this very powerful driving force of small business development, which need attention. Yeah.
Are there pilot projects or beginning to address these issues?
There are some pilot projects with microcredit, but the big question about a pilot project is, can it be brought to scale? I mean, that is the big challenge. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about the projects you are engaged in Rio?
Yeah, this I analyzed this data because, you know, once a data analyst, always a data analyst, and someone said, here it is. But it's because we're now engaged in a project in Irani's research center to look at this problem of youth connection to work in five low-income communities in the city. And we're doing it by talking to the kids themselves. What have you tried? Where have you come up against barriers? Where can't you accomplish what you'd like to accomplish? And by talking to employers, right, why don't you hire kids from these communities? What additional skills would they need for you to hire them? And then by talking to people at the level of the municipality, saying, you know, what training programs do you have? Are they any good? And the one difference I've noticed between this debate here in Chicago and in Rio is here, although it's a theory more honored in the breach than the observance, there is a sense that training is not enough. that for people whose families have been disconnected from the workforce and who are themselves disconnected from their workforce, at least half of the issue is to get a person connected. I mean, almost literally to walk them in the door of a place where they can get a job. But more than that, to stick with them for the next year or so as they do everything wrong and do everything to get themselves kicked out, and gradually help them to learn, right, what it takes to hold down a job. And if I don't know how many of you sort of work between your undergraduate degree and coming here to SSA, but I look at my own children, and when they want to get out of where they are and move somewhere else, they call me up and say, do you know someone in this industry or that industry, right? And because I'm middle class and I've been here a long time, I know someone, right? But if you're a parent in a favela and the kid suddenly says, I'd like to be an architect, you know, I'd like to be a bank clerk, I'd like to be whatever, there's no one to pick up the phone to, right? So you need to, now, within the community, within the favela, there are enormous connections. They're extraordinarily rich, right? So getting a job in the favela, and 60% of the kids in this sample, the job they got through a family member or a friend, right? Those connections existed. But those sets of interactions don't bridge the world between the favela and the middle class economy. Susan.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like, you know, the stuff that Wilson used to write about how people here are isolated. Of course, people in poor communities in Chicago stay poor because they don't have those connections to other communities.
Right.
And one thing that I was really struck by when you were presenting the information is, you know, you talked about the fact that they're connected to a very wealthy area, but only 40% of the kids have jobs. And theoretically, there should be a market out there.
But the market is very limited, and it's for women, as you say, 30% worked as domestics, right? And folks don't have the skills to exploit that nearby market, right?
So are there ways to increase those connections between people who have training and access? I mean, also it sounds like part of what you're talking about is the whole issue, which people have talked about here, around socializing someone.
Right.
To learn what the world of work is not, right, when they haven't been around people who have been working.
Well,
do those systems exist in...
That's precisely what we're trying to figure out. And if they don't exist, how do you create, right? Don't have to look much further than the Chicago community of Austin. It used to be that Austin was surrounded by a whole bunch of manufacturing plants, and the high schools had shop class, right? Mm-hmm. And the teachers who ran the shop classes knew the human resource departments, except they weren't called that then, in all the manufacturing plants surrounding Austin, right? Two things happened. New generation of teachers who didn't have those connections, and manufacturing went bust, right? So at a time, Austin had all these connections to the greater workforce, and now it doesn't. Right. Question here.
I was wondering how your institute disseminates information that... that you gather to, well, who and how?
Right. That's a great question. And my foundation funders ask me that all the time. You're on your way to the MacArthur Foundation.
A programmatic organization that didn't really have people doing research like this for us.
Right.
I don't know, I feel like there might be a disconnect.
I think there really is. We do it in a variety of ways. We have a website, right? But our key audiences are, and I'm just talking about not this work now, but my work at Woodstock, are the bank regulators. There is a truism about regulated industries that the people being regulated have far cozier relationships with the regulators than the people on whose behalf the regulations were written. And it's true. There's a you know, the what was First National Bank and then was First Bank NBD and is now JP Morgan Chase. They have a federal regulator watching what they're doing, living in the bank, right? So they get cozy relationships, right? So what the sort of nonprofit advocacy world has to do is to figure out how to themselves get relationships with the power brokers, the regulators, so there's another side of the story. That's one thing. Then our other clients are community organizations that want to know how to work with banks to get more investment in their neighborhoods. So we do a lot of training and work with community organizations. And then we do a lot of work with the press. In fact, you will see me blasted by Mary Mitchell in the Sun-Times in about a week's time for being a racist. And I'm a racist because I support Speaker Madigan's attempt to stop predatory loans in 10 zip codes in Chicago. And so we're constantly interacting with journalists and with editorial boards and the like. Is that a general audience? No, it's not. It's a specialized audience because with a limited amount of time, you have to ask yourself, who are the group of people I most want to listen to this message? But I think getting information from universities, right, to people who could use it, university faculty, there was a dean at this school, two deans back, who was an expert in the economics of health. And he sat on the Chicago Board of Health because he was a good guy and wanted to influence the world. And he was told by the provost, you should stop doing that. It's going to do you no good. It's going to get you no pay raise. And we don't value that in this university. Right? So even sometimes, I hope it's not true at UIC, but sometimes in private universities, faculty are actually discouraged, right, from spending their valuable time in reaching out to the great unwashed. I mean, it's a real problem. Yeah. There's a question behind you. And you should tell me when we're through.
Just sort of stepping back to the issue of connections that bridge communities. It sounds to me, and this is my introduction to this material, so if I'm misunderstanding it or misreading it, please tell me. But it sounds like there are sort of policy issues that prevent job opportunities from becoming available. And I'm just wondering, are there initiatives at a policy level, but things that are initiatives that may be challenging this really exorbitant work tax for employers, or the fines for having sort of under the table labor in your.
Oh, the policies are there, and the problem is getting implemented, getting them implemented, because there are always people who are used to the current situation, right, and who don't want to see it change. The challenge with the job card is how is the federal government going to replace that source of income? The middle class in Brazil is very highly taxed, right? You can't go that route, and so you have to figure out how to replace that income, right, in order to keep the federal government in the black. Right. And that's a
especially
big issue.
The privileged civil servants you were talking about.
Yes, yes. You know, what's the way to lose a safe seat in this country? Say you're going to change Social Security, right? I mean, it's a hot-button issue. Or raise taxes, yes. Yeah. And I'm not actually going to get involved in what's going to happen next Tuesday, but actually one of the candidates for governor refused to take the oath that she would not raise taxes, which I think is the first time I've heard that in Illinois politics. And she said, it was very interesting, Judy Bartapinka, and this is not an advertisement for her, but she said, who knows when we are going to get our equivalent of Hurricane Katrina? And if I promise that I will never raise taxes, how am I going to deal with that emergency? It was very clever, a way of putting it. Well, she's also been treasurer, right? So she knows what fiscal shape the state is in. Yeah, was there?
Yeah, just I think it's gone.
Okay. Yes.
You were talking about the lack of infrastructure in the favelas, and I lived in Rio and worked in a favela with an organization, with an NGO, that partnered with the drug dealers, basically against the police, which would be, you know, in theory, you know, shocking that an organization that was for nonviolent conflict resolution, what they're working on was a peer mediation project in public schools and favelas. And we found that people were scared of outsiders because their experience with the outsiders are extremely negative, because the police come in and shooting everybody. And they trust the drug dealers because the drug dealers are, in a lot of ways, the protectors of the community. If your baby is sick and you don't have medicine for them, the first person you go to is the dealer in the community, because they have rules where you can't leave your house after 8 p.m., you can't this, you can't do that. But when you need them, they really are there for you. And I was wondering if you've worked with any organization that did sort of non-traditional partnerships to find who actually has the power and how can you use that power for your own purposes?
It's a very vexed question because you're right about what the drug traffickers do, right? And at the same time, it's a very hard question about whether you want to get involved with them.
It's kind of like the Black Panthers here.
Yeah, because they are brutally cruel. And at the same time that they, you know, they provide, you know, the ballet funks on Saturday night, the dances, right, and provide this emergency help, the level of violence is amazing. So it's I mean, we had a colleague once who's came from Chicago to Brazil and started to work with some drug traffickers, and basically said, "Do you really know what you're doing?" And it's a very vexed question. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I would like to say that it's not true today that they are there for the residents. I think there is a major change in the last 10 years that has, the violence has been now much more intense, in the sense that before there was one commando, which is one of the gangs. They had most of the power, and they had like the cartel for themselves. It was violent, but normally the people working for the drug trade were from the communities. So what happened is that they grew up there, and you know, any grandma could come to one of the boys or the leader and say, "Okay, I change your diapers. What are you talking about? Go home. Stop this." And this has changed completely since this, you know, the police started killing under pressure and arresting the leaders. Immediately, what you create is that's happening in Mexico exactly now. There is a war, so the new leaders come and occupy the space, and they have been now moving into different communities. So they are not attached to anyone. And it's very, very different kind of relationship. So now, I would say that there was a period in which, after the dictatorship in Brazil, the community associations were becoming very powerful, important, and it is true that's one kind of democratic space that was kind of lost because the drug trade started taking the leadership. And during, so there were years in which people were not so clear who you were partying with, but today I would say that most NGOs will be respected by the drug dealers, but they will not negotiate, they will not work together, and they will make it very clear who they are partying with, because the truth is that most people hate the police. It's true, and they have good reasons to be scared, but they also feel very threatened by the drug gangs, because they cause a lot of harm and they threaten their lives, and they are very disrespectful of, and they attract the young people. That's the main reason why most, especially mothers, and a lot of the mothers struggling to protect their children cannot face these cruel leaders. So that has been changing quite a lot. And there is a romantic view of how nice they are, because they will pay for, you know, they kill a lot of people, then they will pay for burying them. They do that. Sometimes it is true that they will pay for things, but they also do that as a way to show that we own your lives. So we buy the medication, we buy there is a party, we buy the food. The same way they kill them. So it's very, most people are not proud. When I work in many favelas, most families are very scared, and they are very, young people are very torn about getting engaged. It's really very often out of despair and no alternative, with the exception of kids that really grow up with a lot of violence in their own family, like a history of a lot of drug related relatives, and they are almost growing up knowing that is what is there for me. That you find a difference. Those kids, they are very, they are comfortable in their skins doing that. But the others, they will say, you know, give me anything, any money, any opportunity, and they will choose to live. That's the choice. I'm sorry, I'm very emotional about this, because, you know, they sell this image of being nice in a way that is really deceiving. It's for outsiders, I think, for people outside. Most people don't go in the favelas. So they want to believe it is this way, you know, and that everybody's kind of involved in the drug trade is really, really the minority. And the horrible thing is the commandos have been doing in Brazil, now Mexico, I see very clearly happening after Colombia and Venezuela, and is that no, they are losing the sense of community. You know, when I interview people in the houses, they will talk to me about things they can talk, and the rest is like, they write, they want to tell me, but they can't say it. They can't, they are so scared. And they say, next door are people that tomorrow can be my enemy, can kill me. So they are losing all this sense of being able to trust each other. It's really very sad and recent. We are all so shocked at the way things are now. Very, isn't that true in Mexico?
Yes.
I think I'm about to be cut off. There was a question behind you.
It was when I had said my question, it was just to be cognizant of someone made a comment regarding some of the gang members being in Brazil, favelas being more like the Black Panthers, and that's really not what the role of the Black Panthers was. They were not gang bangers, and they certainly did not their intention was never to brutalize the community or to make money. So, I just want to make sure that that's just not how it is.
Well, thank you all for coming here and for asking an excellent question.
Thank you.